Good morning. Do people know that you're a Christian? I thought about this the other day at work because I've been in a few situations lately that made me wonder if other people knew that I was a Christian. I have vivid memories in high school and college where someone would use profanity around me and then they would apologize. And why would they do that? Because they knew what I believed. And they knew that I stood for, and they knew I didn't care for that kind of language. Recently, though, I've been noticing that people are not apologetic about, using profanity around me. Or they'll make some passing comment that you wouldn't say to a person who you knew had religious convictions. And so I thought about that. Do people know that I'm a Christian? And so I'm asking you the same thing this morning. Do people know that you are a Christian? And of course, I'm not talking in the general sense. There's a lot of people in the world who are Christians. At least they wear the name, but that doesn't necessarily mean very much. I'm talking about Christian in the biblical sense. Do people see that you're different? Do people see that I'm different? If your friends, family, co-workers are not Christians, do they understand that you are? Do they understand who you are? Do they understand why you're a Christian? And if they don't see those things, is that necessarily a problem? I do think Jesus does have something to say about this topic in Matthew chapter 5, verse 14. He says, "You are the light of the world." And then what's he say next? "A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden." And this is an interesting statement, and I think Jesus must mean exactly what he says. It is hard to imagine a Christian that doesn't have a noticeable presence among their peers. Let me say that again. It's hard to imagine a Christian that does not have a noticeable presence among their peers. That's what Jesus says here. You Christians are the light of the world. And so a city that's set on a hill cannot be hidden. It's really hard to hide being a Christian, or it should be hard to hide that you're a Christian. We have a presence, or at least we should have a presence. And so my question this morning is, what is that presence, and what is the light that we shine? I think it should be well understood, especially in this group, that there's no such thing as a closet Christian. Being a Christian is not something that we can just keep to ourselves. We cannot privately be a Christian and then publicly be something else. And so in this lesson, I want to look at four things. There's 100 ways that our Christianity is very public and noticeable to the people around us. But I just want to look at four. There's no particular reason that I'm looking at these four. These are just four things that I find especially important. And maybe on some level, these are four things that we sometimes overlook. This morning, I want to talk about four things the world will notice in us: our gentleness, our generosity, our hope, and our integrity. Again, like I said, there's 100 ways that a Christian will stand out in the world. But these four ways in particular, I think, are very interesting. Our gentleness, our generosity, our hope, and our integrity. In the biblical sense, gentleness is an idea that's often synonymous with a lot of other biblical ideas. Gentleness is very similar, if not the same, as humility, with meekness. And this also carries the idea of being especially cautious or deliberate. And Christians are like this in an unusual way. There's a lot of gentle people in the world who are not Christians at all. But Christians are unusually gentle. So gentle that it's noticed by the rest of the world. And I think this is part of what Paul is talking about in Philippians chapter 4, verse 5. He says, "Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand." Not that we should flaunt or showcase our gentleness, but our gentleness should be especially apparent and visible. And that's really the essence of my lesson this morning. These qualities, gentleness, generosity, hope, and integrity, are not things that we should be flaunting, not showcasing them, but things that should be especially apparent in the life of a Christian because people will notice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. There's another place where Paul talks about this in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24. And I really think this helps to capture the essence of being gentle as a Christian. This is talking about the qualifications for an elder, but of course this is something that's true for all of us. Paul says to Timothy, this is what an elder is like. A servant of the Lord, an elder, must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patience. Verse 25, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance so that they may know the truth. I think all of those ideas are related to gentleness. A gentle person has humility. And in that humility, they correct those who are in opposition. A gentle person is generally a very patient person. And that's the way Christians are. And people notice that. James chapter 3, verse 17. I think this, again, really captures the idea of what it means to be a gentle Christian. James 3, verse 17. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. One meaning of the word gentle is a mild person, a moderate person. Someone who doesn't have a lot of highs and lows, you can count on them being steady all of the time. And that comes out in their personality. Isn't it interesting what James says here about a gentle person? A gentle person is willing to yield. This is something I have to remind myself about a lot. If I have an opinion on something, of course I think I'm right. Obviously, I think my opinion is the best opinion. I mean, is there anyone in here who has an opinion who thinks that it's really not that great of an idea? Of course not. If you have an opinion, of course you think it's the best idea, right? And of course I think my ways are the best ways. I mean, if I didn't think it was the best way, I'd come up with some other way that I did feel like was the best way, right? But you've heard the phrase, we have to choose our battles. And a Christian understands how to do that, and that's part of gentleness. And that's why he says, willing to yield. That's the idea, I think, is conveyed here. That we don't have to have our way all of the time. And again, I say that because it's something I have to remind myself of. Another place that talks about the nature of a gentle person. Titus chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work. Verse 2, to speak evil of no one. And then these three things, to be peaceable, to be gentle, showing humility to all men. And of course, gentleness is one of the fruits of the Spirit. I think gentleness is probably something that's especially evident in our speech. And if we're not a gentle person, it's also especially evident in our speech. This is what Paul says in Colossians chapter 4, verse 6. Let your speech always be seasoned with grace, always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. So what's that mean there? Even if we're gentle people, does that mean that we'll never say something that is offensive or difficult? It doesn't mean that. But if we're gentle as Christians, we're conscious of how people might hear the things that we say. This is what I always tell people about communication. It doesn't matter what you're saying, it matters what people are hearing, which can sometimes be two very different things. And that's what Paul is saying here. Season your speech. Make sure we couch our words in such a way that it's as palatable as possible. That's the idea of gentleness, and people notice that. At work recently, one of my coworkers, well, let me say this first. I already told you that I'm not afraid to have opinions on things, and I'm certainly not afraid to share my opinion on things. But it's important to do that in a way that's gentle. And at work recently, after a meeting, a lady came to me and said, "Tad, how do you say those things without offending everyone?" Now, don't be confused. I absolutely offend people sometimes. This may have been a rare occasion. But I thought that was interesting that she said that. How do you say those things without offending people? I didn't say this to her, but I thought to myself and have thought to myself, well, I've grown up in an environment in the church where people are careful about what they say to each other. We're deliberate in our speech, and we do our best work not to offend people if we don't have to. And I think that's where some of this comes from. There is absolutely a time to be frank and candid, but there's never a place to be disrespectful or hurtful, and people notice that in Christians. This is especially true when dealing with other people's sins. This is what Paul says in Galatians chapter 6, verse 1. Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, considering yourselves, lest you also be tempted. Gentleness is, of course, a Christian characteristic that we learn from Christ Himself. Consider how Jesus is described, and I personally find this to be a very powerful description of how gentle Jesus must have been. Isaiah chapter 42, verses 2 and 3, talking about Jesus, this is quoted later in Matthew, it says about Jesus, "He will not cry out, nor raise his voice, nor cause his voice to be heard in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench. He will bring forth justice for truth." Obviously, there's some symbolism here. Were there times that Jesus raised his voice? Of course there were. And there are appropriate times for us to raise our voice. Were there times that Jesus' voice must have been heard in the streets? Of course. You can't talk to 10,000 people at a time without making sure your voice is heard in the streets. But notice what it says in verse 3. "A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoking flax he will not quench." Just imagine that in your mind. How gentle of a person that must be. A reed that is already bruised. Just this fragile plant that's already bruised. And to handle it so carefully that you don't break it. Think about a pile of flax that's just got the smallest amount of fire in it, so it's barely smoking. And you know, you can imagine those situations where if you get close enough to breathe on it, the fire's out. And Jesus is so careful, so deliberate. He doesn't break a bruised reed, and he doesn't quench a smoking flax. And that's the way Christians are supposed to be as well, especially deliberate and careful, cautious, imagining the consequences of our decisions. And that's why it says in Matthew chapter 11, verse 29, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." That does not mean that Jesus makes everything easy, but he does make things as comfortable as possible. And that's the way Christians are. This next point, I think, is especially important, and I think it's sometimes overlooked about gentleness. Gentleness is not the opposite of ambition. And I think the world is very confused about that idea. Gentleness is not at odds with ambition. A Christian does not have to be a pushover. A Christian is not an underachiever. As they say, meekness is not weakness. And I think we have very strong evidence of that in the Bible. Who does the Bible say was the meekest man on earth? Moses was the meekest man on earth. But what did Moses do? Moses led out of Egypt hundreds of thousands of people. He did that with authority. He looked at Pharaoh in his face and told him that God was telling him to let his people go. Moses was a man who at the appropriate time must have had an extremely powerful presence. But he didn't think of himself in that way. And that's why when God called him to bring the people out of Egypt, he said, "Oh, I can't speak. I can't speak. You really need to have somebody else help me." He was a very meek person. You get the feeling that he didn't really think that much of himself. You get the feeling that he was very humble. And in his personal life, he must have been a very gentle person. But still, a gentle person can be a very influential person. In fact, that's exactly what Solomon says in Proverbs chapter 25, verse 15. Listen to this. Proverbs 15, chapter 25, verse 15. By long forbearance, a ruler is persuaded, and a gentle tongue breaks a bone. I can't say this with 100% confidence, but what I think that last phrase means, a gentle tongue breaks a bone, I think what that means is a gentle person can be incredibly powerful and persuasive. And I think that's absolutely true. You know, there's usually two kinds of people that rise to the top. The people who are willing to step up on everyone else on the way up there. And then there's the other people who are especially gentle and meek and careful and cautious. And those are the Christians. So do keep in mind, gentleness is not the opposite of ambition. Meekness is not weakness. This caution that a Christian uses is not the opposite of influence. All of these things work together. A Christian is very gentle. Secondly, a Christian is very generous. And I do mean this in the broadest way possible. A Christian is a very generous person in every way that you could imagine. In their benevolence, in their compassion, in their goodwill, a Christian has a genuine concern for his fellow man, both in the church and out of the church. And I think this idea is discussed in Galatians chapter 6, verse 10. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. So Christians absolutely have a particular obligation to people inside of the church. But if only the people in the church understand our generosity, we're not fulfilling the scriptures. Do good to all men, all people, should be the recipients of a Christian's generosity. And what does this mean specifically? Well, certainly in regards to material blessings. Think about what Paul says to Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 18. Let them do good. Let all Christians do good. That they be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share. And that's really the way I'm thinking about this morning, is especially in terms of our material resources. Again, in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 16, but do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. This generosity, of course, should include sharing our physical resources, but certainly in every other way as well. Our compassion and our benevolence is really at the heart of the Christian religion. And again, this is something that people will notice about you. Now, I can tell you that I doubt that people notice this about me. So this is something that I feel like in my own life I need to do better at. But it is an expectation that comes from God. That we are especially compassionate, we're especially benevolent, we're especially generous. James says so in James chapter 1, verse 27. This is another very specific example. And this, again, I think speaks to just how benevolence is really at the heart of the Christian religion. James chapter 1, verse 27. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the fatherless is this: to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. There's a lot of ways that you can sum up Christianity. But James says you can sum it up in these two ways. Number one, a Christian is unspotted from the world. So people will notice that a Christian is an especially pure person. But people will also notice, again, that you're an especially generous person, that you've taken care to ensure that the fatherless and the widows have received the attention that they need. Matthew chapter 14, excuse me, let's go to Luke chapter 6, verse 33. Another place that speaks to the generosity of Christians. Luke chapter 6, verse 33. If you do good to those that do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. Verse 34, and if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? For even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much back. Verse 35, but love your enemies, do good, and lend, hoping for nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for He is kind to the unthankful and the evil. I want to make sure, since we're talking about generosity, I want to make sure that we all know exactly what this is saying. The expectation is that Christians will be giving money, real money, real Benjamins, to people who need it. And I don't know that I always thought about that in my own life. You know, a lot of people give loans knowing that they'll get the money back. But Christians give money to people who need it, having no expectation that they'll ever get that money back. And once you start to do that, it is a really good feeling. And I absolutely believe that God blesses us for that generosity. And of course, people notice it. Matthew chapter 14 is a very interesting story regarding the generosity of Jesus. In this chapter, this is where we read about John the Baptist being beheaded. And we'll pick up in verse 13. So John the Baptist has just lost his head. And this is Matthew chapter 14, verse 13. Then Jesus heard it. He heard that John the Baptist was martyred. And he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself. But when the multitude heard it, they followed him on foot from the cities. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude. And he was moved with compassion for them, and he healed their sick. This is interesting. So Jesus just realizes, of course he knew this already, but so he realizes that John the Baptist has just died. A very important prophet in the Bible, and then of course a relative. And you get the feeling that Jesus just wanted to be by himself for a minute. He gets in a boat, he goes across the sea to a deserted place. I think the implication is Jesus wanted to be by himself for a minute. Maybe to mourn for John, maybe to pray for John. He just wanted to be by himself. And then these crowds of people, they find him. And he looks up and he sees the multitude. And then what's the feeling that overcomes Jesus? It's compassion. And so what's he do for those people? He heals their sick. This story is a little bit different than many of the other times that Jesus heals. Usually when Jesus heals, the primary purpose of him healing a person is to demonstrate his divinity, to prove the message that he's preaching. But in this case, I get the feeling that Jesus does it for no other reason than he knows that he can, and he just wants to help these people. And I think that also should be the attitude that we find in a Christian, that we do have a tremendous concern for the people around us, and as much as possible, we want to help people. I'm not saying that we should cast our pearls before swine, but I am saying that the nature of a Christian is that we want to help. And we don't really have any expectation that people will help us in return. But like I said earlier, there is a reward for this. God expects our generosity, but He also promises to repay us for our generosity, even in this life. Luke chapter 6, verse 38. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. And then the same idea is mentioned in Proverbs 19, verse 17. He who has pity on the poor lends to the Lord, and he, the Lord, will pay back whatever he has given. So this is God's promise to us. That if we are the kind of people that are benevolent and generous with our money, with real money, of course the same thing is true with our time and our energy and our other resources, but God talks specifically about money. If we're generous and benevolent with our money, God will be generous with us as well. And of course people will notice that. Christians are gentle, Christians are generous, and then Christians also have a kind of hope that is very noticeable among their peers. Christians have a unique perspective on life, and this is absolutely apparent to the people around us. They will notice this hope, and they will actually ask us about this hope. This is exactly what Peter says. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for what? A reason for the hope that is in you, with meekness and fear. There's a lot of different ways that we may get these questions. So why are you so sure that you're going to heaven? Do you actually believe in eternity? Why are you so attached to the Christian religion? What makes you think that God actually cares about you? What makes you think that God is going to get you through these trials? Why aren't you worried about this? Do you ever hear those things? Why aren't you worried about this? Well, I think that's what Peter is talking about. People will ask us about the hope that we have. That question will be couched in many different ways. But people will notice that we don't have the concerns of the rest of the world. That we have our hopes fixed on eternity. And in the biblical sense, the way that God uses the word hope, hope is not some unfounded desire for something that's outside of your control. Oh, I hope it rains tomorrow, or I hope this happens, or I hope this happens. Hope is confidence. Hope is an educated expectation that God will fulfill His promises. We have worries and concerns, of course, but our worries and concerns are tempered by our knowledge that God will see us through. Again, hope is confidence, a genuine conviction that God will see us through. This is exactly what Paul says to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 12. For this reason I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed and am persuaded that he is able to keep what I have committed to him until that day. Paul was completely convinced that God would fulfill His promises. God has always fulfilled His promises, and He'll continue to fulfill His promises. I think our late brother Tom Woody is surely a very good example of this. Tom didn't say this to me, but Tom said this to Matt Harvey, and Matt Harvey said it to me, and I thought it was such a good statement. I saw a lady the other day wearing a shirt that said, "I hate cancer." And I don't fault the lady for wearing that shirt. I understand the sentiment. But Tom one time said to Matt Harvey, and Matt Harvey said to me, Tom said, "I don't hate cancer. I don't hate it." And when you were around Tom, you got that feeling, didn't you? He didn't hate cancer. He wasn't mad that he was sick. He wasn't mad at God. I don't even get the feeling that he was even disappointed that he was sick. I'm sure if you gave him the choice, maybe he would have said, "Yeah, I'd like to live longer. I think there's some work that I could do." But isn't that the nature of a Christian? I almost wonder if the people that were working with Tom in palliative care and the people giving him therapy treatments and people giving him the chemotherapy, I wonder if they ever said to themselves outside of the room, "This guy's weird. He's not upset that he's so sick. He's not depressed. He's not disappointed. He almost seems happy about it. What's wrong with this guy?" I can almost imagine those kinds of conversations happening, because that was the kind of hope that you could see in a person like Tom. And that is such a good example for the rest of us. Eventually, all of us are going to get sick and die. It's going to happen. I want to be like Tom when I'm in that situation. And I want people to think I'm weird, because I'm not bothered by the fact that my end is approaching. People notice that, and in various forms and in various ways, people will ask. And so what is it that people notice? What is this hope that people see inside of us? What is it people might ask us about? Romans chapter 15, verse 13. Now may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. God is the God of hope, and therefore our lives abound with joy We're overcome with peace. We live in this hope. And that's what Christians are like. Tom was a good example of this. Most certainly, Paul and Silas were a good example of this. When I think of people who are happy in the most awful situations, I think of Paul and Silas. They'd just been beaten and thrown into prison, and what were they doing as they sat there in their prison cells? They were singing. Acts chapter 16, verse 25. But at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God. Does anyone know what it says next in that verse? Just out of curiosity. I thought it said this, but I couldn't remember until I looked it up. They were singing and praying hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Isn't that the perfect example of how we get into situations where people ask us about our hope? The prisoners were listening to Paul and Silas, and I'm sure they were thinking the same thing. These guys are odd. What is wrong with these people? They're in prison and they're over there singing. Christians are noticed because even in the worst situations, we still have hope. We're gentle, we're generous, we have hope. And then lastly, Christians have an unusual integrity. And when I look at this room, I see a lot of people who have an unusual amount of integrity. The importance of Christian integrity is a thread weaved throughout the entire New Testament. Christians are odd people in this way. We're often going against the grain. We believe things that can make people uncomfortable or even angry. And because of that, because Christianity at its core is not really politically correct, it's very, very important that Christians live with the highest level of integrity. And this is the raw truth. Christians must be blameless. This is part of the reason that Christians don't do things that aren't necessarily wrong, but because it might give us a bad name. I'm not even going to list any examples for you because I don't think it's necessary, and because some of these issues are potentially, personal preferences. But I know you can think of things that you could do if you wanted to, and it wouldn't be wrong, but you don't do it because you know people are watching you, and they want to see that you have some vice so they can dismiss your Christianity. There's lots of examples of that. Here's how Paul explains the idea to Titus in Titus chapter 2, verses 6 through 8. Titus 2, starting verse 6. Likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded, in all things showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you. It is very important for a Christian. Now, obviously, we are people prone to sin. We will make mistakes. It'll happen. It does happen. We will make mistakes. But even in our mistakes, it's important that we still have the highest level of integrity. Integrity, incorruptibility, those are the words that Paul says the world will use to describe us. Sound speech that cannot be condemned, so much so that the world has nothing evil to say about us. When you think of people in the Bible who had an incredible amount of integrity, people in the Bible who carried so much integrity that people couldn't even come up with evil things to say about them. Who do you think of in the Bible? What's that?
Jesus.
Absolutely. When he was crucified, they had to hire people to lie about what Jesus had done wrong. Another person I think of is Daniel. Daniel had become a very powerful person in the Babylonian Empire, and obviously that bothered some of his subordinates. They didn't like it. It bothered some of his peers. And so they wanted to take Daniel down. And so what did they do? They thought about it, and they thought about it, and they thought about it. They could not find anything that Daniel had ever done wrong. There was nothing evil to say about Daniel. Wouldn't you want people to say that about you? I just can't think of anything evil to say about your name. That's the way Daniel was. So to get him into trouble, they had to make up a law. A And that law was that you couldn't pray to anyone except for King Nebuchadnezzar. Here's what the satraps say about Daniel in chapter 6, verse 4. So the governors and the satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault, because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. And that's important as a Christian. As a Christian, we do things sometimes that we don't feel like we have to do, but because it's important that we carry integrity with us. We do things sometimes that, again, we just don't necessarily feel like we have to do. Maybe things that we don't think we should have to do. But we do it anyway because it's important that we're found to have integrity. I hope my lesson this morning was helpful. It was helpful to me because, like I said, people should be noticing us. We shouldn't be showcasing our Christianity. We shouldn't be flaunting it. We shouldn't be bragging about it. But we should be living in such a way that people find us interesting. That people find us unusual, at least to the extent that they're interested in asking us about what we believe. And I've had those experiences, not as often as I'd like, but I'm sure you've had those experiences too, where people come to you and say, "Well, so where do you go to church? Or what do you believe?" They want to know those things. And if people respect you, they may learn to believe those things as well. Be gentle, be generous. Make sure your hope is apparent in the world, and make sure that you live a life with the highest level of integrity. Again, thank you for your attention this morning. This lesson was meant for me as much as it was for you. Eric, you have a closing number for us?
507. 507.